The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. drone over Mardin province, the sixth such biplane downed in Yemen this year. At least two protesters are killed, several others wounded by security forces in Sudan during demonstrations against a military takeover. And a car bomb blast in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, leave an unknown number of casualties. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marzia Hashimik, right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Yemen this hour. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a U.S. spy drone over its Mardin province, a key region witnessing fighting for months now. Army spokesman Yahya Sadi says the drone was of Scan Eagle type. He says it was the sixth U.S. spy drone shot down by Yemeni forces this year. Well, the announcement comes as the Yemeni army continues fighting against Saudi-backed former regime loyalists to liberate Mardin. The army has in recent weeks made significant gains. Meanwhile, the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen has confirmed that its terrorists have fought alongside Saudi-led mercenaries there. Saeed Batarfi says the battles have taken place on 11 fronts. Saudi Arabia denies such cooperation. Earlier, we talked to Yemeni political commentator Hossein al-Bakhati. Says the army, by downing the U.S. drone, has cut Saudi's access to information needed for airstrikes on Mardin and elsewhere.
We have seen from the beginning of the war that the Saudi-led coalition depend like 100% on U.S. drone and as well on Saudi drone to collect information about area they will target, and they could. At the beginning of the war, conduct hundreds of airstrikes in the latest advance toward Marib. Marib is most of Marib and Al-Jawf province north of Yemen is a desert. So it should be easy for the Saudi airstrike to target Yemeni forces in that area. But actually, it was totally the opposite, that because Yemeni army have upgraded their air defense missile, they have taken down almost all Saudi and U.S. drones over the sky of Yemen, and this actually have cut one of the main information supplies that they used to depend to attack Yemeni forces.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Anti-coup protests in Sudan have once again turned deadly after security forces violently clashed with demonstrators. Medics say at least two protesters were killed and several others injured. Police used live rounds and tear gas to disperse protesters in the capital, Khartoum, and in its twin city of Omdurman. People took to the streets to condemn a new ruling council by the military that lacks civilian leaders. Coup leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan announced the formation of the council on Thursday and named himself as its head. Well, the military seized power late last month, arresting dozens of government officials, including the prime minister. At least 16 people have been killed during protests since the coup. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review, Jonathan Ofe-Ansah, publisher of Africa Briefing out of London, and Julius Mabalatu, radio host and political analyst, also out of London. Thank you both for being with me, actually, as I'm getting this in right now, that today we have three anti-coup protesters who were killed so far. The latest is that three have been killed. Jonathan, starting off with you, I mean, where is this going to go? Because we saw the coup, and then we thought we were seeing somewhat coup leaders giving in and understanding that this couldn't be sustained. Where are we now in this?
Well, we are, chaos, you know, straight to the eye. Because with the formation of the new sovereign council by General Burhan, right, it appears the military have now entrenched themselves in power, because the composition of this new administration, you know, has only one, you know, member of the former, of the ousted civilian wing, you know, of the former administration. So it appears, you know, General Bohan and his military comrades, you know, have really entrenched themselves in power. That's on the one hand. And the, on the other hand, the Sudanese civil society are also determined not to allow this to continue. They are determined, you know, to restore the status quo, to have, you know, the deposed Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, you know, reinstated. So we have some sort of extremity here, and with the resources at the disposal of the junta, I mean, when I say resources, I mean with the security agencies at the disposal of the junta, it appears we are going to see maybe some more bloodshed. As you said in your report there, already three people, at the last count, three people have been killed in the demonstrations by the security forces. And we shouldn't be surprised if there are more fatalities, you know, in the days ahead, because the Sudanese civil society are not going to relent like they did with the general deposed President al-Bashir. They are not going to relent in their demands for restoration to civil rule.
Okay. Well, Julius, your take on all of this, because, of course, now that we are seeing more people being killed, then it's obvious that what's probably more likely to happen is that more people are going to continue to take the street and demand a return to civilian rule. Where do you see this at this point in time, and where is it going?
Of course, the key thing is that the military seems to be very much placing itself strategically to kick up with the rule of military rule, of course, with the formation of the new ruling council, and of course, self-appointment of our baron to head this new ruling council. The military seems keen and determined to go ahead against the wishes of the Sudanese, against the wishes of a lot of people across the world. Of course, we've seen protests everywhere. Now, with their determination, then also civilians and, of course, Sudanese are also determined. Remember, right now, the protest is in the hands of the people who are keen to send Omar Bashir home. And this is the Sudanese Professional Association, also with the Resistance Committee. These two are key, and now they're in the mainstream of the protest. And we are talking about now 1 million march, so it's not just a few people. So from my understanding, it's the beginnings of a major conflict now between the military and the protesters, of course. And of course, we are sadly enough, you have some military being supported maybe by some quarter somewhere, but that kind of giving them illusion that they can carry on, and also with the protesters, I don't see them stopping. I see them going all the way, because they want power handed back to civilians.
So let me just stop you there, Julius. You say you see them going all the way. Do you have expectations then from external forces, the international community, if you want to call it, or perhaps neighboring African countries? What type of expectations do you have, and from which entity?
Definitely, even locally, I would imagine, you know, it was not just enough to send or kick out Sudan from Africa Union. That was not enough. It was good, but it was not enough. I think within the setup of Africa Union by now, they should be strategizing, figuring out how they can, even if it's to form a force that can oversee mediation. Also, in collaboration with the international community, willing partners to broker peace, we're talking about even if it's EU, US, United Nations. My expectations are like, don't just leave Sudan alone until it is too late. You see, the thing is, military rulership in Sudan has always had a kind of impunity. stinging impunity. We see ICC issuing a warrant of arrest for Omar Bashir, but it was crisscrossing African countries, and the deal was any member of ICC, African country, it comes to your territory. Make sure you effect that arrest warrant of ICC. Make sure that is the moment that he will be arrested. But we saw lack of political will, and it's like presidents of Africa, they become buddies, like friends. You cannot arrest you, you are my buddy. That kind of attitude has to go, because it causes a lot of injustices to continue to be perpetrated by those in power.
And Jonathan, your expectations, do you think that, for example, the African Union can play a role in this, or which entity do you think can be more effective in pressuring coup leaders?
In fact, when it comes to external role in resolving the situation, I would totally discount African Union, because, like Gideon said, you know, I even cited the example of the ICC's arrest warrant on former President Bashir, where he went to South Africa and he was expected to be arrested. South Africa had a Zuma was the president at that time. Zuma refused to arrest him, you know.
So,
I mean, the African Union is like, I call it, you know, the old men's club, you know, it's a top shop, right? They are full of top. They don't have the political will, right, to effect certain changes, political changes on the continent. And again, like Gilio said, yes, they become like branches, you know, like buddies, right, who have each other's back. So the African Union is completely out. Well, the Sudanese, the junta used to have support from Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt. And so far, the UAE and the Saudi Arabia have distanced themselves from the actions, right? Egypt at the Al-Sisi so far has been very, very quiet. But we don't know how far the UAE and Saudi Arabia, the other Middle Eastern countries, how far they've distanced themselves from the actions of the Gantas, okay? But now, for Monday, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, is embarking on a four-nation tour of Africa, Senegal, Nigeria, Kenya, and one other country, ostensibly to help broker, you know, negotiations in not just in Sudan, in Ethiopia, and other countries as well. So let's hope, you know, the U.S. intervention. Already, the World Bank has withheld $700 million worth of aid to Sudan. The IMF is doing the same. And also France, which was considering a debt forgiveness, is rethinking, you know, that strategy. So I believe the external influence will not come from the African Union. I don't have any confidence in the African Union, I'm afraid. But the external influence will come from not even the UN, but from the US and maybe the allies in the Middle East and the U.S. Secretary of State.
Okay. And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you being with me on this news review. Jonathan Ofe-Ansah, publisher of Africa Briefing, out of London, also out of London, Julius Mabatutu, radio host and political analyst. Thanks so much for staying with us on this news review. Turkish police have arrested an Israeli couple on charges of spying for Tel Aviv. The couple was detained for taking photos of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's residence in Istanbul. They were said to be taking pictures of adjacent security checkpoints and cameras as well. A Turkish national who was with the couple was also arrested. Reuters footage later showed the couple leaving a courthouse and being taken to prison. But a Turkish news agency said they were formally arrested pending trial for, quote, political and military espionage by an Istanbul court. The case appears to be escalating into diplomatic tension between Ankara and Tel Aviv. Israel has rejected Turkey's spying claim and requested an urgent consular visit of the couple. The blast hits a Shia populated neighborhood in the Afghan capital of Kabul, leaving an unknown number of casualties. An unnamed Taliban official claimed that 6 people were killed and 7 others injured after a magnetic bomb attached to a minivan detonated in western Kabul. Taliban spokesman, however, gave a different narrative of the incident. Sabihullah Mujahid said the explosion was caused after a vehicle caught on fire, leaving 1 civilian dead and several others injured. Now, the area is heavily populated by Shia Hazaras, a community regularly targeted by Daesh terrorists. The country has witnessed a series of explosions since the Taliban's takeover in mid-August. More than 120 people were killed in Daesh-claimed blast targeting 2 Shia mosques in October. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Spyware made by the Zionist regime's notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of 6 Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading Zionist regime spyware targeted Palestinian human rights workers. Stay tuned for more. Spyware made by the Zionist regime notorious NSO group was used to hack the phones of 6 Palestinian human rights defenders, according to a report published recently. 3 of the 6 targeted groups, including Al-Haq, Adamir, and Defense for Children International Palestine, have cooperated closely with the International Criminal Court investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip by the Zionist regime. The Israeli regime seeks to sabotage that probe and consolidate decades of impunity. The fake regime of Israel accused the targeted groups of serving as arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance group banned by Tel Aviv, Washington, and Brussels. The Zionist regime has not produced evidence supporting its claims. A 74-page secret Israeli regime dossier purportedly proving its case relies on the testimony of 2 former employees of a 7th Palestinian organization outlawed earlier in the year who are currently in the Israeli regime detention. The Zionist regime likely obtained their testimony under coercion that may amount to torture. Ireland's government, which funds 2 of the banned groups, dismissed the dossier as containing no credible evidence. International condemnation and skepticism did not, however, prevent the terror designation under the domestic Israeli regime law from being extended by military order to the West Bank, where the organizations are based. The use of NSO Group's Pegasus spyware against Palestinian human rights defenders was revealed by Frontline Defenders, a group based in Ireland. Adam Shapiro, a spokesperson for Frontline Defenders, told the New York Times that the investigation did not definitively prove who used the spyware, but it raises a lot of questions as to the role not only of NSO but also of the Zionist regime. Frontline Defenders stated that the timing of the terror designation's blacklisting Palestinian human rights groups suggests that it is also an effort to legitimate the surveillance of their staff. The Israeli designation of these organizations as terrorists after Pegasus was detected, but just days before this investigation is reported, appears to be a clear effort to cover its actions and disconnected from any evidence that would discredit these organizations, the Irish group said. Frontline Defenders was contacted by Al-Haq in mid-October about the device of Al-Quds-based staff member and a possible infection with spyware, according to the report published recently. After determining that the device had been infected by NSO Group spyware in July 2020, Frontline Defenders began investigating the devices belonging to the staff of other organizations newly designated as terror groups. They found that five additional devices were hacked with the same spyware. Citizen Lab, based at the University of Toronto, and Amnesty International Security Lab confirmed with high confidence that the phones were hacked with Pegasus, Frontline Defenders said. Pegasus is the name of the spyware made by NSO Group. The hacked devices belong to Ghassan Halaika, a field researcher with Al-Haq. Obey Al-Aboudi, director of Bisson Center for Research and Development and a U.S. citizen, and Salah Hamouri, a lawyer with Adamir, who the Israeli regime seeks to deport to France for breach of allegiance to Israeli regime. The three other targeted persons remain anonymous. The U.S. Commerce Department blacklisted NSO Group and Candiro, another Israeli regime company, last week. The sanctions bar the companies from buying parts and components from U.S. companies without a special license. NSO Group in particular has come under increased scrutiny with every new report revealing the extent to which its spyware has been used to target journalists and human rights defenders around the world. The Pegasus spyware can be installed remotely on a targeted person's smartphone without requiring them to take any action, such as clicking on a link or answering a call. Most notoriously, the use of Pegasus was linked to the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi inside Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. Democracy for the Arab World Now recently called on the U.S. to investigate the hacking of the phones of the Palestinian human rights defenders and impose sanctions on those found to be responsible. Four Democratic House lawmakers are also calling for sanctions on NSO Group, arguing that the Commerce Department designation would still allow U.S. investments funds to finance the company. When U.S. investors prop up companies like NSO Group, this implies the asset of the U.S. government, encouraging such companies to continue providing dangerous tools like Pegasus to the most repressive governments, the lawmakers state in a letter to senior administration officials. Meanwhile, a federal judge recently denied a motion by NSO Group to dismiss a lawsuit filed by WhatsApp and its parent company Facebook, now rebranded as Meta, over the targeting of 1,400 of its users with Pegasus spyware over 2 weeks in 2019. NSO Group claimed that it was entitled to foreign sovereign immunity, a protection afforded to government officials even though it is a private company. John Scott Railton, a researcher with Citizen Lab, said that this lawsuit going forwards is a massive blow to NSO. The recent revelations of the use of NSO Group's Pegasus software to spy on Palestinian human rights defenders marked a convergence of what had previously been two separate diplomatic issues for the Israeli regime, as noted by the New York Times. NSO Group exports its spyware under licenses from Israeli regime's War Ministry, which issued the order designating six Palestinian human rights groups as terrorist organizations. The Times noted that, according to the Israeli regime policy, Pegasus cannot be used by a foreign government against Israeli regime phone numbers, such as those belonging to the Palestinians in the outlawed groups. The publication added that an Israeli regime agency, however, would have the authority to use the software against an Israeli number. The new military order outlawing the Palestinian groups in the West Bank puts the organization's staff members and their property at imminent risk of raid, arrest, and reprisals, according to Al-Haq. The military order is wide in scope and may be used to target broad swathes of Palestinian society, including witnesses to and survivors of war crimes. The order states that every member of Al-Haq, whether he is incorporated, associated with it or not, whether he operates on the internet or in another way, and every group, cell, and faction, institution, central branch, or faction thereof, is an illegal organization in the meaning of the defense regulations. Al-Haq said that the military order is based on British Mandate-era emergency regulations that were repealed shortly before the end of the mandate and therefore no longer apply. According to Al-Haq, the Zionist regime has repeatedly resurrected the repeated British Mandate order dating from 1945 to outlaw any form of peaceful assembly since its military occupation of the West Bank began in 1967. The rights group said that the Israeli regime's culminative campaign of persecution aims at gradually normalizing its inhuman acts of persecution and apartheid towards Palestinian human rights defenders. The Israeli regime is enforcing its threats with total impunity and complete contempt for the strong statements of condemnation from the UN treaty bodies and officials and European states that followed its initial terror designations in October, Al-Haq added. Recently, Al-Haq called on the European Union and third states to remove terrorism clauses as internal conditions placed on donor funding to Palestinian organizations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The rights group also called for comprehensive trade sanctions against the Israeli regime, emphasizing the need to end the sale or supply of military products to the state.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Tonight, the topic that I want to reflect upon is the deception of this world. So in chapter 57, which is what I want to focus on for tonight, verse number 20, Surah Al-Hadid, the chapter of iron, Allah brings a very unique verse. And Allah says in this verse, اِعْلَمُوا, understand, recognize, know this reality, أَنَّمَا الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا, that this present worldly life is a series of things. What are the things Allah wants to tell us? He's going to tell us five different things of what this world is. The first thing is لَعِب, play, and لَحَو, what we will say is vain talk or amusement. Wazina, this world is a show of ostentation, of bragging, of showing off what we have, the good stuff. Wattafakhurun, it's a mutual boasting, competing with one another. And tafakhurun bainakum wattakathurun fil amwali wal awlad, it is a competition in more wealth and more children. And then what happens is Allah says at the next part, he says kamathil al-kuffar, that the rain comes, wa'ajaba al-kuffar nabatuhu, that the rain comes, the beautiful water from the skies comes, it waters the crops, and the farmer becomes amazed. Now you might say, well, where did I get the word farmer from? But Allah used the word kuffar in this verse. And we should realize, just as a side note, let me say that the word kafir, you know, we use this as for non-believers. We say that person is a kafir. Allah uses the word kafir in the Quran multiple ways. One is for an unbeliever, but also uniquely is that a farmer is also a kafir. Because what is a kafir? Literally, a kafir is one who covers, kafara. Kafara is to cover something. So when we say that that person who is not a Muslim is a kafir, they're covering the truth. A farmer is a kafir because he takes a seed, puts it in the ground, covers the seed with dirt. He's covered over the seed. So he's a kafir. But not in the same meaning of a kafir as in a non-believer. In any case, I just wanted to let you know that, because if you look at this verse and you say, why is Allah calling farmers kafirs? Because that is the term that Allah uses in the Quran. So Allah says that this life that you and I lead of these five stages, not independent of one another, they're correlated, they're interrelated. He says that now think about a farmer. A farmer goes outside, he tills the land, he puts seeds in the ground, and then he covers the seed, it begins to rain, or he waters the crops, and the vegetation begins to grow. Now the farmer, he spent weeks and months, and especially for you who live in Calgary, if you just go a couple of kilometers outside of the main city, you'll see hundreds and hundreds of acres of farmland. You'll see horses and cows, and I'm sure you've seen this before. You'll see fields of canola growing and wheat and different products that farmers are growing. But what you will not see is that a farmer will not just plant and then leave it to rot. No, that would be foolish of them. So they put the seeds in, as the Quran says. The rain falls, as the Quran says. The farmer becomes happy, as the Quran says. And go and ask the farmer, you know, what happens when it rains? And they're overjoyed when they get the right balance of sun and rain to grow the crops and to irrigate the crops. But then Allah says, the farmer just sits back, kicks his feet up, he relaxes, and the crops that he grew, they begin to dry. They go from green, they begin to wilt, they turn yellow. And then Allah says, ثُمَّ يَكُونُ هُتَامًا, they become like straw. He didn't harvest the crops in time. It become worthless. There's no benefit to that now. Allah says, think about that example of your life. You're given the blessings of Allah. You're given this entire process of birth up until 40 years and then beyond to grow and to mature just like the crops. But what do you do with your life? You just waste it away to wither, to come into nothingness? Or do you harvest at the right time and make the most of what Allah has given to us? Allah ends the verse by saying that there is in the akhirah, in the hereafter, adhabun shadid, a very painful punishment for those who don't use the abilities that God has given, who become deluded. Fala taghurrannakum, don't let this world delude you. But there are some who do that. And Allah says, for them is adabun shadid. But don't forget that Allah balances the equation always in the Quran. Yes, there is adabun shadid, but there's also maghfiratun min Allah. There's also forgiveness from Allah. So Allah, our God, Allah is not a vengeful God. He's a loving God. He's a caring God. Allah does not want to see you and me go into hell. He did not create us for the hellfire. Will people have to be reprimanded? Of course. We would be naive to think otherwise. But Allah did not create us to go to hell. He's a merciful God. He is a God of rahmah. And so he says that there is also maghfiratun min Allah, and even better than the maghfirah of Allah. Now, what could be better than God's forgiveness? Ridwan. The pleasure of Allah. In other ayat, Allah says, وَرِضْوَانُ مِنَ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ, that the pleasure of Allah, that is the greatest thing that we could ever attain. Allah says then, وَمَا الْحَيَاتُ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا مَتَاءُ الْغُرُورِ. What is the life of this world, if not anything except a transient, a passing enjoyment of delusion? Again, what a beautiful parable, brothers and sisters, if we looked at the world in the light of this one particular verse. Again, chapter number 57, Surat al-Hadid, the chapter of iron, verse number 20. If we look at the farmer again, and just think about this, that a farmer goes through all of that struggle to plant and to harvest the crop, to be able to sell it in the market, to feed his family, to feed himself, to feed his livestock, maybe if he has horses or cows or chicken. He does all of that work for a goal. He didn't grow the wheat or the canola for the sake of growing it. He grew it for a goal, a purpose. Now we have to ask ourselves, is that do I use my life in this world as the goal? Is this all a goal, to eat, to wake up, go to work, go to school, get a job, make money, and repeat? Or are all of these ways to get to the goal? What is the goal? Maghfiratun min Allah wa ridwan, the pleasure of Allah. Right? So we have to recognize and ask ourselves personally, what is my purpose on earth? Why am I here? Why do I follow this path of Islam as taught by Muhammad and Ali Muhammad alayhim wassalatu wassalam? Am I being used by the system? Am I being deceived by this dunya? Am I being deceived by the internet, by TikTok, by Instagram, by Snapchat, by Facebook, by Netflix? Is Hollywood using me? Are the commercials and the industry of television using me as just a pawn in their game? Or is there something much greater than all of this? Now, I'm not saying don't use technology, don't use the dunya. No, as I said, we use the dunya to get to the akhirah, to get to Allah. But we have to ensure that we think about this fact and recognize that we as believers, as human beings, as followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad alayhim wassalatu wassalam, we have to realize that we make use of this world, but we do not let this world make use of us. We live in this world, but we don't let the world live within us. We benefit from this world, but we don't let the world benefit off of us. We use this world for what it can give us to get to Allah. And that includes even the some of the pleasures, the halal, the lawful pleasures. But we have to be careful that we don't exceed those limits and become deluded by the world.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali. محمد وآل محمد
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight. In California, the state's insurance department's most recent data showed non-renewals of homeowners' insurance policies rose 31% from a year earlier in 2019 to more than 235,000. We have prepared for you an article written by David Shepherdson. The piece is titled Risky Business: Climate Change Turns Up the Heat on U.S. Insurers' Policyholders. Tony and Jahan Dunn never thought they would leave California, where they grew up, built a life together, and planned to retire. But after a wildfire swept through their Northern California town of Paradise 3 years ago, burning their home to the ground, they could not get insurance to buy another. Dunn, a retired planning specialist, told Reuters news agency from the couple's new home in North Carolina, "We basically got priced out of California." There are thousands of homeowners and businesses from California to Australia in a similar position, because the insurance industry, known for its readiness to cover anything from Bruce Springsteen's vocal cords to alien abductions, has trouble factoring in climate change. Industry experts say the tried and tested approach, where decades worth of historical data serve to estimate future claims, falls short when weather patterns change and hurricanes, floods, heat waves, and snowstorms become more extreme and unpredictable. And the British host of the United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow acknowledged on Wednesday, 10th of November, that current pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions were not enough to avert climate catastrophe. Insurance brokers AON said in a report recently that highly anomalous floods in Germany and China this year caused record insured losses in those regions. Attila Toff, chief executive at specialist risk analytics firm Zesty AI, says, "And if they don't trust their traditional models, then they are concerned that they will be losing money." He added, "Insurers are pulling out because nobody wants to be in the business of losing money." Zesty AI, whose customers include Farmers Insurance, Reinsurer Berkshire Hathaway, and AON, uses artificial intelligence trained on more than 1,400 wildfire events to produce climate change risk scores for any individual property. In the same vein, reinsurance broker Willis Ray is using data from artificial intelligence firm Cloud to Street to help clients price flood reinsurance. Insurance statistics show an urgent need for such innovation. For example, according to Lloyd's of London insurer Chaucer, the average number of large US wildfires has risen by 30% over the past 15 years and by nearly a fifth in just the last 5 years. In all, data compiled by Swiss RE shows insured losses for so-called secondary perils such as floods and wildfires, rather than more closely modeled perils such as hurricanes, nearly doubled over the past decade. The reinsurer expects no let-up forecasting a 30% to 63% rise in insured losses for all types of natural catastrophes in advanced markets by 2040. China, Britain, France, and Germany could even see those soaring between 90% and 120%. Given the momentum, Bruce Carnegie Brown, chairman of insurance market Lloyd's of London, told the Reuters news agency, "It is no surprise that traditional models cannot keep up." He said, "If you've reached an exponential part of the curve where suddenly something's accelerating, it's almost certain that we are underpricing the risk that we're taking." Policyholders are already feeling the heat, with insurance coverage getting costlier or harder to come by. Broker Marsh estimates U.S. property insurance rates have risen by 10% in the third quarter. In California, the state's insurance department's most recent data showed non-renewals of homeowners' insurance policies rose 31% from a year earlier in 2019 to more than 235,000. According to Carmen Balber, executive director of Consumer Watch LA, the data for 2020 could be similar. Across the northern border of California, the Insurance Bureau of Canada warned on its website homeowners might not be able to buy a new insurance policy if they have suffered a fire. Among those pulling back from home insurance in California are some household names such as Liberty Mutual, Nationwide, and State Farm. Liberty Mutual said it was a difficult but necessary step to reduce overexposure to wildfires, a sentiment echoed by other insurers. Some insurers aim to reduce their exposure by helping clients become more resilient. For example, commercial insurer AXA offers a consulting service for clients such as manufacturers, identifying their vulnerabilities and suggesting remedies, such as erecting flood barriers. Its chief risk officer, Renaud Guidi, told Reuters news agency, "This is really an alignment of interest." Paul J. Crump, vice chairman of Chubb Group Global Underwriting and Claims, said, "U.S. insurer Chubb is also working with clients to help them make their infrastructure sturdier." Analysts say reinsurers, with their global scope and long history of underwriting catastrophe risks, also have a role to play in helping the industry adapt to climate change. Ernst Roach, chief climate and geoscientist at Munich RE, said the group had the expertise and willingness to take on climate risk. Ernst Roach said the 141-year-old company set up a team to work on natural catastrophes and climate change in the 1970s, after noticing loss patterns starting to change for weather-related events. He said, "We observed a continuation of years with losses significantly higher compared to the last 35 years or so, and that's reflected in our models. Yet there was a gap between what the reinsurer considered a fair premium and what insurers were prepared to pay." Ernst Raunch said, "We can only transfer this risk to our balance sheet if we get the premium which we need to cover these risks based on our own assessment." Ratings agency Standard & Poor Global warned even reinsurers could be underestimating their exposure to climate risk by as much as 50%, describing their efforts to account for climate change as nascent in a recent report. Industry experts also say disasters such as hurricanes in Florida, with a long history of causing severe damage, are more closely modeled than floods or wildfires, which have only in recent years begun to cause major losses. That calls for reinsurers and independent risk modeling firms such as RMS and KCC to try new ways of approaching natural catastrophes. Laurel Mariscott, senior director EMEA and CIS at RMS, which sells its risk models to insurers, said one such approach is scenario modeling, where insurers are provided with a number of possible climate impacts on their portfolios over years to take account of the whole range of uncertainty. Laurent Mariscott said, for example, another involves machine learning, which can be used to take existing models of floods in a particular region and map them to other parts of the world. But any developments in making insurance more available and affordable will come too late for the Dunns. Tony Dunn said, I was sad because we both spent our whole lives in California. We both grew up in San Diego. He added, I never had any intention ever of leaving California. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
On the nuclear issue, the US has truly passed all limits in their brazenness. There is no difference. Trump said it in one way, and the current administration says it in another way. We should pay attention to this. Behind the diplomatic scene, the US is truly a predatory wolf. In appearance, it is diplomacy. They smile, speak, and sometimes talk with self-righteousness. But in reality, they are a savage, vicious wolf that shows itself in many parts of the world. Of course, they sometimes appear in a wolf's clothing, and sometimes in a fox's clothing. They take on many forms. One manifestation of this today is the situation in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is our brother country, sharing the same language, religion, and culture. The crisis and sufferings in Afghanistan truly move an individual.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The incidents that are taking place one after another, the incidents that took place on Thursday at the Kabul airport, the killings, the problems, and the hardships they are going through are the US's doing. They occupied Afghanistan for 20 years and brought all sorts of oppression against the Afghan people. They bombarded their mourning ceremonies and their weddings. They killed their youth. They imprisoned many individuals without any reason in different prisons, and they increased the production of addictive drugs in Afghanistan by tens of times. They did all of these, but refused to take one step to help develop Afghanistan. In other words, if today's Afghanistan, in terms of civil rights, construction, and other such developments, is not worse than those days, it is not better either. So, the US did nothing. Now that they are leaving, it is in such a disgraceful way.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.